This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
By thanking the Pomerantz family for sponsoring this series. This is the third of the series, and I know there are some people here who have been to all three, and I think we really have, through each of the three lectures, really gained a broad perspective on Megillat Esther, and tonight will be no exception. There might be formal introductions that Michael Eisenberg gets, but I want to give what I think is the greatest accolade to Michael, which is that it is not too many people who are at his level in the business world who also spend their time writing Torah, studying and writing Torah at a high level. And I think to that, he is certainly a role model for me. I'm in the world of chinuch, and I don't need to deal with the business world, but you somehow managed not only to have published a book on Megillat Esther in Hebrew and in English, but also a Sefer on the Yerushalmi. And in that regard, he is really an exemplar for us all. Your mum is there cheering.
Well, the exemplar for us all is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein on some level. My father, too, is a Talmud, so...
And as many of you know, if you've read his bio, Michael is a real leader in the high-tech world here. And his book, The Vanishing Jew on the Megillat Esther, has given a really biting commentary to Megillat Esther. And we're really looking forward to hearing your presentation tonight. Everybody has source sheets? We've got source sheets? Okay, great. So without further ado...
Thank you, Alex. Alex and I first met in Yeshivat Har Etzion more years ago than we care to announce this evening. And welcome. And it's an honor to be here, and thank you, Alex, for inviting me. I'm going to only cover part of tonight is what appears in the book, and for those of you who want, there's copies of the book outside in English. I'm going to try to lift ideas that come from the book and combine them with things I've actually learned since I published the book, and offer a slightly different perspective on Megillat Esther. As I was coming here today, I landed a couple hours ago on a plane. As I was heading to the plane, somebody said to me, "Did you see the New York Times review of the new book coming out this week on Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump?" I told them, "No, I had not yet seen the New York Times review of the book, nor the book." And the guy said to me, quite appropriate because Purim is coming. And I decided I wasn't going to delve into what that meant because I'm sure everybody could have their own both political and religious interpretation of that comment. But I'll just put it here on the table and you can all walk away and do what you want with it. And what I want to look at actually is start with three very short psukim in the Megillah that are critically important. I will show are critically important, but we tend not to pay attention to these three short psukim. And I'll say them in Hebrew first, and I can translate to English if anyone needs, but it starts at the end of the second parak of the Megillah, and it talks about two eunuchs, Bigtan and Teresh, two eunuchs. Vayemi Mahem, in those days, Umordechai Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech, Katzaf, Bigtan V'Teresh Shnei Sarisei HaMelech Mishomrei Asaf, V'Yivakshu L'Shloach Yad B'Melech HaChashverosh. And it was in those days, Mordechai is sitting at the Shar HaMelech, at the gate of the king, and these two eunuchs, Bigtan and Teresh, became angry. They were angered, Katzaf. And they have this title, Shomrei Asaf, minister, secretary, we'll come back to it in a minute, and they want to kill the king. This pasuk is dramatic, and it's dramatic for a few reasons. One is they want to kill the king, but the Megillah does not explain to us why they want to kill the king. The second thing is it has a title for them, what their place in the kingdom is, but it doesn't explain what that means, Shomrei Asaf. You'll note that if you go through Perek Aleph in the Megillah, we have endless numbers of the advisor to the king. Yodei Das Vadin, Akrov Elav, Karshana Shesar, Admata Tashish, Meres Marsanam Mubuchan, the Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech, Shivat Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech. In Perek Bet, we have Narei HaMelech Mishartav, the lads that are servicing the king. And all of a sudden, we run into Shomrei Asaf, no fewer than six different titles for people who help the king, and this is yet another one, but we don't know what it means. And we don't understand Mordechai is Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech, but again, the Megillah does not tell us why. And then the rest of this is well known. Vayivada Davar LeMordechai, he understood. We don't get into that today. He tells Esther, she tells the king, and in fact, it was true. And they write this down in the king's memories book, Book of Memories. Bad memories or good memories, we'll come to in a second. And these two eunuchs are now hung from the center of town, obviously in great display so that nobody dare do this again. Machiavelli is fond of saying that if you are going to put down an insurrection, you should hurt the person dramatically so he does not think of retribution. So too, Bigtan Vateresh found themselves hanging for this attempted palace overthrow. And what I want to first look at to try to dig into what happened here, and we'll understand in a second, this is critically important. Why is this critically important, these three psukim? Because what comes right afterwards? Achar advarim ha'ele, after these things, gidal ha'melech ha'chashvosh et Haman, right? The antagonist of the Megillah, Haman Agagi, Haman, the hater of the Jewish people, comes right after this, and they're clearly connected, right? Achar ha'dvarim ha'ele. So it behooves us to try to understand what is actually going on here. So there are three approaches that I'm aware of in the commentaries to explaining what the Shomrei Asaf is. I'm going to offer a fourth. The first one is Rabbi Yosef Kara, who says that these people, Shomrei Asaf, Shomrei Akelim, they are the people who watch over the vessels of the kingdom of the king, right? These people call them guards or people who sit around to watch the storeroom of the vessels of the king, Shomrei Akelim. The Rashbam explains how we come to this notion, and he says, Shomrim Le'Kelei HaMelech, the Shomrei Asaf, watch over the vessels of the king. How do I know? Utvaltem Badam Asher Basaf. We'll read in Parshat HaChodesh in a few weeks, right? That when Bnei Yisrael were commanded to take the Korban Pesach, they slaughter the animal, the blood drips down. Where does it drip into? The Saf. And what do? You take the Ezov, the Hyssop, Utvaltem Badam Asher Basaf, and you dip it into the blood that is in this vessel, and you spritz it on the mezuzot and the mashkof of the house, right, on the doorposts of the house. So he says, Saf, where I capture, it's the vessel in which I capture the blood. Saf, Shomrei Asaf, I know what that means, is the people who watch the vessels that in the case of the Korban Pesach receive the blood, and in the case of the king, perhaps they are his favorite golden vessels in which probably less blood is accumulated because he hangs the people and does not murder them. And then we have Rashi in Sefer Melachim, which we'll come to right now, and who says something somewhat inverse to this, which is he talks about the kelim that in fact the Shomrei Asaf, Vayitzav HaMelech et Chilkiyahu HaKohen HaGadol et Kohanei HaMishneh et Shomrei Asaf, Lotzi Me'echal Hashem et Kol HaKelim HaAsuyim LaBav LaAsher Chol Tzva HaShamayim. What are these Shomrei Asaf? These are the people in the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, towards the end of the first Beit HaMikdash, who are commanded to take out those vessels that were dedicated there to idols, right? And to idol worship. So the idol worshippers had brought into the Beit HaMikdash these kelim, these vessels, which were used in idol worship, and these Shomrei Asaf were asked to take them out. So on one hand, they're protectors of the people who watch over the kelim, the vessels. On the other hand, they are the people who take these out. And this is kind of an interesting transition, which we'll come to in a second. Rashi says that these are kind of semi-doormen who also take care of the vessels and the kelim. But we'll come back to that in one second. In the meantime, I want to look at option two. So first option is Shomrei Asaf, people who watch over the vessels in the kingdom. Number two is the Ralbag. And the Ralbag says, he does a reverse engineering of a famous Gemara. The Gemara says, how did Bigtan Vateresh want to kill the king? They wanted to drip some poison into his wine. Sama mavet. They put some poison in his wine. This is obviously related to the famous midrash about the Sar HaMashkim. The Sar HaMashkim in the time of Yosef is jailed. Why is he jailed? The midrash says because a fly flew into the cup of wine. Right? So, okay. So he wasn't careful about the cup of wine. He lands in jail. It must be that if Bigtan Vateresh wanted to put the Sama Mavet, the poison, into the cup of wine, what must they be? The Sarei HaMashkim. So this king Achashverosh, Paro had one Sarei HaMashkim, Achashverosh had two. Biktan Vateresh, says the Rabag, these two people who were the vintners or the Sarei HaMashkim of Achashverosh wanted to kill them, and that's what Shomrei Asaf means. Shomrei Asaf, Sarei HaMashkim. It's hard to understand. The words don't mean that. They mean Shomrim, someone who watches over something, and Saf is definitely not wine. Nonetheless, that is the reverse engineering by the Rabag of that. So a more attractive Perush, perhaps, is that of the Mitzudat Zion, which is kind of a bridge from what I said in the name of Rashi beforehand, where he says, Shomrei Asaf HaShoarim, the doormen, or the people who stand at the village gate. They have the keys, they let who they want come in and come out. So who are Biktan Vateresh? Bayami Mahemu Mordechai Yoshev Bishar HaMelech. He's sitting at the gate of the city. Katzaf Biktan Vateresh. Biktan Vateresh became angry. Mishomrei Asaf. They are one of the doormen or the gatekeepers of the king's palace. And they decide they're going to kill the king. It's unclear if Mordechai is outside the gate or inside the gate or whether these two eunuchs had let him in. And so this is an attractive pirush, except it misses one thing, which is Shomrei Asaf, by the way, in this case, the word Saf means door plane, right? People who cross over the door. It does not explain why they are angry. Katzaf, Biktan, Vateresh, Shnei Sarisei HaMelech. Why are these two eunuchs angry enough as the doorman of the king's palace to go kill the king? Someone got in bad. Someone broke in. What are they angry about? They didn't like that the king was on the other side and they were on this side of the door. It's not clear. And Rashi, in the next one, Yuchas Rashi in Divrei Yamim, basically explains the same thing, where you have another case of Shomrei Asaf in the text of Divrei Yamim. And Rashi says, basically, these are the doormen. I like to say these are the selectors in the bars in Tel Aviv. They get to know which cool people get in and which don't into the king's palace. For whatever reason, these guys were these two eunuchs were unhappy from what was going on, you know, in the lobby of the king's palace, and decided to take out their vengeance on the king. I said before, and I'd like to reiterate, that these are fundamental questions. They're fundamental questions because the Megillah turns on Biktan and Teresh entirely. What happens after Biktan and Teresh? Achar advarim ha'ele gidal ha'melech ha'chashverosh et Haman ben Hamdata. It's a retzif. It's a continuation. Achar advarim ha'ele. After what happened, Biktan Vateresh, comes Haman. Not only that, but if we go all the way ahead to Perek Vav, which we'll also come back to, how does the tide turn against Haman? Because the king Achashverosh remembered, Al Asher Yigid Mordechai al Biktan Vateresh, that which Mordechai said and told them and saved his life from Biktan Vateresh, it turns the whole Megillah around. These two people are the most important people in this entire Megillah. The whole story turns on what they did. But we spend a little time trying to understand. I see people are chuckling. I'm actually very serious. This is an absolute turning point in the Megillah. These people are important. So before going to what I would like to explain Shomrei Asaf means, which I think is important, I want to ask the following question, which is, what was Haman's job? So if Achar Advarim Ma'ele Gidal HaMelech HaShosh Tamam Ma'anata, after what happened with Biktan Vateresh, Achashverosh decided he needed a new viceroy, which I understand what was the job of this viceroy, because it's a priori in relation to what happened right before, right? So there are basically four approaches. There's two more ancient, one, two more modern. Ironically, by the way, very few Mefarshim deal with what was Haman's job. Even fewer deal with why were Biktan Vateresh angry. Which we'll come back to. So Rashi says that Haman, what was his job? He made himself an Eloah. Eloah meaning a god. This requires some historical context. So what Rashi means is not what we all grew up with as kids, that Haman had a necklace that had on it an idol. But rather, in the Roman times, it was well known that the Caesar was like a god. And they would actually create statues of the Caesar. So much so that the Mishnayot and Avodah Zarah, if you look at how do you make an idol no longer an idol, you take the ear off the idol. It's not the Jews, by the way, the Goyim take the ear off the idol. And the reason that works is once you take the ear off, it means that this person is no longer a Caesar, and therefore he can no longer be a god. And so Rashi basically says, Haman, the viceroy, he kind of was like the king god of Persia. It's a little anachronistic, by the way, because obviously the Romans come 500 years or so after the Persians, but nonetheless. Most of the Farshim just say that Haman was like the Rosh Memshala. He was like the Sara Sarim. He was the most senior among the ministers. Okay, Kidal HaMech HaShrosh at Haman Ben Amdata, a priori then, Bigtan Vaterosh must have been the previous senior ministers, but we should understand why. Yoni Grossman, that was an incredible book called Megillat Starim. I don't know if it came out in English. About the Megillah, he does this unbelievable job of trying to draw out hidden meaning in the text and textual alliterations. And he says that Haman was the bodyguard of Ahasuerus. What happened? Bigtan Vaterosh tried to kill Ahasuerus. Wait a minute. There's an insurrection in the palace. We need to have a bodyguard. Who's the bodyguard? Haman. And Haman becomes the bodyguard of the king. Gidal HaMelech HaShrosh at Haman ben Amdata. Please protect me, dear Haman. The fourth approach, which is fascinating in its historical context, is from Rav Beni Lau. He has a little kind of almost pamphlet on the Megillah, in which he says that the backdrop to all of this, and this is important, does anyone know how much time is Achar HaDvarim Ha'ele? Right? In these time between Bigtan Vaterosh and Haman, anyone want to hazard a guess how much time passes? Rashi says 5 years. And most likely that's correct, because that's what the Megillah says. Also, 5 years passes. Now, very important to understand that whoever wrote the Megillah was not writing a history book. And we'll touch on this in a second. This is somebody's observation of events that did happen, might have happened, but it's his telling, it's his narrative. So when he says, Achara Dvarim Ha'ele, yet 5 years passes, he's connecting between the two events. That's very obvious. But 5 years pass. And Rav Beni Lau fills in the details of what happened. He says, right in this period right now is a war between the Persians and the Greeks. And in that time, there's this wild midrash that doesn't appear in normative sources, but is out there, which says that Mordechai and Haman were competing generals in Ahasuerus' battle. Mordechai did an okay job. Haman did a better job as a general. And when he came back, he is now appointed the Secretary of Defense, the Sar Bitachon. So Haman says, Rav Beni Lau, Achad Vrim Ma'ele, is not referring to Bigtan Vateresh, but rather is referring to this battle that is not reported in here quite purposefully. Whoever wrote the Megillah did not record the battle. He recorded Achar Adrim Ma'ele. We'll go on. And I want to offer a fourth explanation. So just to recap, three explanations to what Shomrei HaSaf are. What is the job of Bigtan Vaterosh? The first one is they were the watchers of the Kilim. They were the people who watched over the vessels in the king's home. The second is the Ralbag, who says, excuse me, I'm a little tired. The Ralbag says that, how am I blanking? The Ralbag says, right, that they were the Sara Mashkim. They were the vintners of the king who tried to put the poison in the king's cup. And then the third approach here is that they were the doormen. Shomer Asaf means the doormen. I totally agree with that. We're going to come to that in 1 second. Very good question. Very, very good question. So, so those are the three approaches to that. And again, we tried to look at who was Haman, what was his job. So, what is your name?
Dov
asked, okay, if there are doormen or people who watch the Kelim or the Sar Mashkim, why do we need to know, why does the Megillah tell us that they were eunuchs? That's one question. I also want to reemphasize the question, what are they angry about? What are these two people angry about, so angry that they're going to attempt to kill the king and put their lives on the line? And again, what does that have to do with Haman becoming the viceroy of the king? So I want to look at what I think are the real parallel sources to this, some of which I've brought already, but we'll take a look at them again. So in what's titled number four here, and I'm going to argue that Shomrei HaSaf should really be read as Shomrei HaKesef, the guardians of the money. And if you look in Sefer Melachim Perek Bet, Sefer Melachim Bet Perek Yud Bet, the Navi tells us, "Vayikach Yehoyada Kohen Aron Echad," and Yehoyada Kohen takes one cabinet. "Vayikovcho B'dalto," he puts a hole in the door. "Vayiten Oto Etzam Mizbech," and he places it next to the Mizbech. Miyamin. People would come to the Beit HaMikdash. They had money they wanted to contribute to the Beit HaMikdash. And where would they put it? In the Aron, in this cabinet, next to the Mizbeach. And who would put it there? The Kohanim, Shomrei Asaf. So the Kohanim, who also have a title of, they're priests, but they also have a title of Shomrei Asaf, they're responsible to put the money into this cabinet. Let's go to the next one. Melachim bet kaf bet dalid. Alei al chikiyahu hakohen hagadol. V'yatem hakesem uvar beit hamasher asu shomrei asaf me'et ha'am. Who would the Shomrei Asaf do in this case? They collected the money from the people. So on one end we have Shomrei Asaf who put the money into the cabinet. On the other hand we have the Shomrei Asaf who collect the money from the people. In one case, I would call it the treasurer. And in the other case, I would call it the controller. Right? To use English phrases for people who handle money. The next pasuk from Lachim Bet. Vayikach Rav Tabachim et Tzraya Kohen Arosh v'Tzfanyahu Kohen Mishneh v'et Shloshet Shomrei Asaf. I bring this down because the Yerushalmi in Masechet Sanhedrin tells us that this pasuk, from this pasuk, we learn a very, very important klal, and that is communal money should only be distributed under the aegis and supervision of three people. You require three people, Shomrei Asaf, in order to distribute and allocate communal money. Next pasuk. Vayavor el chikiyahu ha-kohen ha-gadol itnu ha-kesef ha-muvah beit elohim asher asfu ha-levi'im Shomrei Asaf. So now we have people called the Levites, the Levi'im, but they are also referred to as Shomrei Asaf, because what is the context? Vayitnu et hakesef. They take the money. They are collectors of the money. And I could go on. The Malbim and the Radak point out that these sources are related, right? So who are the Shomrei Asaf? If you read the Navi carefully, every time the word Shomrei Asaf is mentioned, it deals in one way or another with money. They're either the treasurers, the tax collectors, the secretary of the treasury, or the controller of the money that comes, in this case, into the Beit HaMikdash. And what I want to suggest is that Biktan V'Teresh are the Saro Tsar, the secretary of the treasury, the chancellor of the exchequer, I think you call it in the UK, of Shushan, of Persia, of the Persian Empire. These people have a huge job in the Persian Empire. They are in charge of the finances, the budget, the money of the Persian Empire, of Ahasuerus's kingdom. Now, we haven't answered Dov's question yet, which is, why does it matter that they're eunuchs? We'll come to that in a second. We also haven't understood what they're angry about. So I want to pay very careful attention to the verses in the Megillah and attempt to explain what these two eunuchs are angry about. And let's pay attention to the other two very important events of the Megillah. What are they? The parties. The whole Megillah starts with a party. It's obviously an important event. But we'll start with the second party. Esther Perek Bet. These psukim appear right before the story of Biktan and Teresh. Vayas ha-melech mishteh gadol l'chol sarav v'avadav et mishteh Esther v'anachal m'deot asa v'ayitein maset ki yad ha-melech. Vayas ha-melech mishteh gadol. What's a mishteh gadol? A big party. A great party. Right? Mishteh gadol. Big party. L'chol sarav v'avadav. To all of his servants and slaves at Mishteh Esther. Is it really a big party? We have another party in this Megillah, which happened how many years before? 3 years to 4 years before, right? Before the Melech gets lonely, he had a very large party at the beginning of the Megillah. A really large party. Vayas HaMelech Mishteh Gadol, sarcastic. This is not such a big party. You want to see a big party? Look at the first barak. Next source. Bishnat Shalosh Lemalcho, in the third year of Achashverosh's kingdom, Asa Mishteh L'Chosarav Avadav. Until here, that is the same people who appear at Esther's party a few years later. Chel Parasu Madai. We have other guests. HaPartamim V'Saram Dinot Lefanav. And look what he did at this party. Barotot Osher Kivod Malchuto. He took out the riches of the kingdom. V'Tikar Tiferet Gedulato. And all the other great tributes that he had gotten. Yamim Rabim Shmonim U'Ma'at Yom. Not Mishteh Gadol, Yamim Rabim, 180 days. Uvimlot Hayamim Ha'ele, Asa Melech, the Chol Ha'am, everybody, the whole people, Hanimtzim B'Shushan Abira, LeMigadol V'ad Katan, men, women, children, everybody in the middle, Mishteh Shivat Yamim, B'Chatzar Ginat Bitan HaMelech. He made them what? A seven-day party in the garden of the palace. And look what's there. Chur karpasu tchelet, achuz b'chav libutz v'argaman, gli'i kesef, amudei shesh. It's like Hollywood. Right? It's like the Oscar night. That's a big party. 180 days, another seven. Not just sorem v'avadim. Everybody. Megillat Perkpet is sarcastic. This is not a mishteh gadol. This is a mishteh mitzumtzam. A limited party. It only has the sorem v'avadim. We don't even know how long it went. But not only that, look what else Achashverosh does. After this big party, quote unquote, he then starts giving out gifts. What is hanacha? What did Moshe Kachlon do right before the elections now? In modern Hebrew, we call it a discount, but it's of taxes, right? Hanacha lamdinot asa. It's like an election time where you want to give out gifts to people in the kingdom or in the state. So we reduce their taxes. And what else did he do? What did he do? He gives out gifts also. Do? I don't know. But he gives out gifts. Why is the king giving tax reductions? Why did Moshe Kachlon give tax reductions and shovel money to the policemen and the firemen before the elections? To win their favor. Why does he want to win their favor? Because he's nervous. His seat is shaking. Why is his seat shaking? So when you contrast the party in Perek Aleph, which was really a big party, to the small party in Perek Bet, we understand something's gone on here. In between Perek Aleph and Perek Bet, we have a financial crisis in the kingdom. The king's coffers have dwindled. The king's coffers have dwindled. We had giant parties. V'yein malchut rav kiyad ha-melech v'ashtia chadat ein ones. V'yein malchut rav kiyad ha-melech. We gave out incredible amounts of wine kiyad ha-melech. Here, ma'item aset kiyad ha-melech. We gave out what we could. Nothing rav. Not a lot. That was in the first parak. Here, everything is far more limited. The guest list is limited. The amounts are limited. And not only that, we're going to give out tax breaks so that we shouldn't have an uprising of the citizen. So what happens right after that? Katzaf, Bigtan, Vateresh, Shnei, Sarisya, Melech, Mishomre, Asaf. We now understand what they're agitated about. What are they angry about? These Shomre, Asaf. These are the treasurers. These are the controllers. These are the guys in charge of the money. They take a look at this Esther party, limited party. They look at the limited guest list. They say Achashverosh is handing out handouts to the whole kingdom so they can get reelected, right? So you won't have a overthrow of the kingdom. And they go, oh my, we have a problem. We have a financial problem in this kingdom. By the way, financial problems take down kings and governments every time. The famous comment, people vote their pockets, is true. It turns out that people revolt also. By the way, I just finished reading an unbelievable piece. I'm blanking on who the author is right now. Pharaoh overthrows in the ancient Near East and ancient Egypt due to famines. That relates to Yosef. But either way, when you have a financial crisis in a kingdom, people get antsy. Not only do people get antsy, in this case, the secretaries of the treasury, the chancellor of the exchequer, and the Sar Otsar, Bigtan and Teresh, are antsy. Now, back to Dov's question. We understand why it's important that they're eunuchs now. Because what do they care about? Just the kingdom. They have no children. They have no offspring. These guys are willing to risk their life. They have no family. Just to save the kingdom from financial ruin of the largesse of Achashverosh and his poor management of the finances of the kingdom. He was a king who did not know how to run this economy. He didn't only run the economy. If you go back to what I said about Rav Benny Lau before, he had a very expensive war. We actually know a lot of presidents who've had lots of very expensive wars over the last 12 years. And it hurts the economy. It's expensive to run wars. It's expensive to change wives, especially when they're queens. Right? And so we have very clearly between Perek Aleph and Perek Bet a financial change in the kingdom that bothers these two eunuchs who have nothing to lose on a personal level except the honor and the existence of the Persian kingdom. And they take on Ahasuerus. Now, who is Haman? This should be obvious at this point. After these things, what is his new job? He is the new secretary of the treasury. He replaces Bigtan and Teresh. They had two guys who couldn't get their act together to try to kill the king because he was being a spendthrift. And how can we confirm that this was Haman's attraction to Ahasuerus? What does he offer him?
Money.
10,000 silver talents. Talent, by the way, is how they describe the silver bars in the Persian Empire. 10,000 silver talents. He offers the king in order to destroy the Jews. Now, this falls on open ears, obviously. Why? Because we're in a financial crisis for which Bigtan and Teresh tried to revolt. They were killed. Mordechai saves the kingdom. Who's he doing at Shaar HaMelech, by the way? What happens at the Shaar HaMelech? It's Sefer Yirmiyahu, not the only place. When Sefer Yirmiyahu, Yirmiyahu castigates the kings and the Sarim of Yehuda, for what? Allowing commerce at the Sha'arei Ha'ir, allowing commerce at the gates of the city on Shabbos. At the Sha'arei Ha'ir, all the trades and all the commerce happens. This is true, by the way, throughout ancient history. The place where you did trading, the place where commerce happened, the place where money changers sat was right at the gates of the city. And that's where Mordechai is sitting. And that's what happens. And Haman is appointed king. Now, we can skip ahead. I don't know what page it is. I used to have page numbers on here, but Alex inserted English, so now I'm out of control. So I'm looking at this. It's titled at the top, once again, Anti-Semitism in Europe Before the Holocaust. Yes?
Did they predate Ahasuerus? Who? In their world,
don't know.
That's not part of your thing.
I don't know. I try to stay an analysis of the verses of what's going on and attached to the words. Historical speculation I'm not good at. But we have a new Secretary of the Treasury who is bribing the king. Now, by the way, I'll put as an aside, you can take and do whatever you want. I actually reference it in my book in a footnote. But Herodotus says that the annual tax collection in the Persian Empire, if my memory serves correctly, is 9,970 silver talents. It's very close to 10,000 for those paying attention. Just an interesting curiosity. But Haman, as the case may be, our new Secretary of the Treasury, rises to power and is able to bribe the king with 10,000 silver talents to wipe out the Jewish people. This should not be unfamiliar to us people sitting in this room. This, unfortunately, is the course of many parts of Jewish history. There is an incredible, I think it's about 120 pages, research report done by two fellows named Brownstein and King, entitled Anti-Semitism in Europe Before the Holocaust. What I find really, really, really interesting about this is they didn't just kind of take a broad look at Germany, for argument's sake, or Poland. They looked at each province and the levels of anti-Semitic activity in each province. And I think that's actually super important. We need to get down to local resolutions to understand these things. And no one should understand or walk away from here as me saying that there's any justification for anti-Semitism. That is obviously not the case. I'm trying to analyze where it grows when it starts to grow wildly, right? Because we have periods of less anti-Semitism, and then it seems to sprout up. So we need to ask ourselves, on what ground does this cancer grow? So these two researchers basically argue the following. There are two core and one slightly side reasons for fast growth in anti-Semitism. Number one, a down economy. People down on their luck. People having a hard time making ends meet. People who are in financial distress. That's one. We take that as somewhat obvious, but it's not, because we have a hard time understanding what it means that people are down on their luck and have financial hardship, because it vacillates or changes between different provinces, right? You can have, we take America as an example today, we have what they call the coasts, which seem to be blossoming in the center of the country, which is having financial hardship, right? We have different towns in different places, and that's what Brownstein and King get into with regard to Europe. The second cause they point to, which is going to shock some people, is the delta in Jewish immigration into that province. But when you think about it, it will make sense, which is how many Jews or what percentage of the population of Jews did I have in this province before versus how many do I have now? The larger the delta or percentage change of the influx, the higher the anti-Semitism. And these two things together, financial hardship and an increase in the percentage of Jews in a given province, is toxic for anti-Semitism. It becomes very, very fertile ground for anti-Semitism to grow. As a throwaway, I'll tell you, the third item that they identify in some of the cases is some Jew joining the liberal left parties of those places. And the reason is also counterintuitive, but obvious, which is the academic elite lives on the liberal left. And when you start to penetrate that, or the Jews start to penetrate the academic liberal elite, the left becomes threatened. And that's when you get what you have right now, which is that the extreme right and the extreme left are actually converged. By the way, anyone studying political theory, the political spectrum is not a line. It's a horseshoe, right? Which is that the extremes, left and right, are actually far closer to each other than the center is, for another time. So this is what they say. Now, I bring this graph from the New York Times of about a week and a half ago from a column by David Leonhardt. There's actually a study out today suggesting that this fourth line down has turned up in the last 2 months. But nonetheless, here's what you see in this thing. So the top line is the 0.01 percenters in America. The next line is the 1 percenters. They've done pretty well over the last 45 years of economic development in the United States. Everybody else has had stagnant income for the last 45 years, meaning that the economy is not working for a large swath of the American population whose purchasing power and income has not grown. Go to the next page, you'll see another three graphs. So this graph is that while Americans' paychecks are bigger than 40 years ago, their purchasing power has barely budged. Now, what's striking about this, by the way, this means if you adjust for inflation, right, which is how much money is worth, people's purchasing power is not growing. What's stunning about this is the cost of everything has gone down dramatically, right? You can buy an air conditioner today for far less than you could buy it 40 years ago. You can buy a refrigerator for far less than you can buy it 40 years ago. Everyone's got a home computer and a smartphone, right? But purchasing power is not moving for a large percentage of the American population. We must ask why. The next one is, what is real wage growth? That's from the Federal Reserve. And the last one is France. France is even worse, because not only is it not going up, it's going down. The people's inflation-adjusted wages are down in France over the last 45 years. Now, averages lie, by the way, so you should really look for the medians, but unfortunately, very few people put out median income. But this tells you a story. It is a fertile ground for anti-Semitism, right? And there's a fair amount of immigration to France over the last 60 or 70 years of Jews. It's a different Jewish population than was there in the time of Rashi, right? But, and there's been obviously immigration into the United States. Now I want to ask a question. We've spent the last 35 minutes discussing the financial crisis of the Persian Empire, the desire of these two Shomrei HaKesef, Shomrei HaSaf, to murder the king because they're worried about the financial future of the Persian Empire, the rise to power of the new finance minister of Persia who wants to wipe out the Jews through a bribe to the king, and he hatches this plan and sends it out with the horses, and they go out and they're going to kill the Jews. Right? That's the plan in Persia. What happens at the end of the story? The end.
The Jews reverse the whole
And they don't kill the Persians. Well, maybe some Persians they do, for sure, like 75,000. But what does it relate to the beginning of the story? Who was killed? Haman. He was killed, right? So how long passed between the decree of Haman to kill the Jews, his request from Ahasuerus to wipe them out on the 14th of Adar, till he was hung? Anyone want to hazard a guess? How much time passes?
Less than a year.
How much? Before you answer that question, let me ask you a different question. Over how long a period does the Megillah take place? 10 prakim of the Megillah, 10 chapters. How long does it take place?
12 years.
What?
12 years.
Close, 14. I go back to the last question. Over how much time passes between Haman sending out the cavalry to kill the Jews and he's hung?
4 days.
4 days. We have 10 chapters of the Megillah, 13 years, and everyone walks around saying that the story of this Megillah is they try to kill us, we killed him, let's party. The whole thing is 4 days. Then it takes 11 months till that day comes and they turn around. But the tide has turned in 4 days. I would argue that cannot be the story of this Megillah. That is the background. That is the easy topic to talk about. And now I want to ask you a harder question. What does the name Mordechai mean? Anyone know? What? Marduk. Who is Marduk? The Persian Babylonian god. And what does the name Esther mean? Ishtar. What is Ishtar? The Persian Babylonian goddess. She came with the name, though, before she was called Esther, which was Hadassah. And Mordechai changes her name to be Esther. And I want to ask you to look at, a Gemara in the Babylonian Talmud in Masechet Megillah, in which Rav Ashi, the person who finishes the Talmud Bavli, Chotem HaTalmud, says the following. Amar Rav Ashi, says Rav Ashi, Kol Vayihi, anytime it says the word Vayihi, that introduces tons of Tanakh, Vayihi, Vayihi, Vayihi. Ika hachi v'ika hachi, there are some like this, meaning some are good and some are bad. Vayihi b'mei, Einu ela lashon tsar, the term Vayihi b'mei Achashverosh, for example, is only painful. Chamisha vayihi b'mei avu, there are five times the Tanakh says Vayihi b'mei. The first one, because they're in Masechet Megillah, Vayihi b'mei Achashverosh, even though it's the last one chronologically. The next one, Vayihi b'mei Shvot HaShoftim, we'll look at that in a second, the story of Rut. The next one, Vayihi b'mei Amraphel, Melech Shinar, Yoch Melech Elasar, Kedor La'omer, Melech Elam, V'tadal Melech Goyim. What is that? The first world war that we ever had in this world, in the time of Avraham, when Lot is taken into captivity, and Avraham needs to save him. The next one, Vayihi b'mei Achaz, as God is about to decree the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and then the time of Vayihi b'mei Yehoyakim, when Yirmiyahu castigates Yehoyakim and says to him, how dare you take betza, how dare you take bribes to kill people, to kill other Jews, how dare you, says Yirmiyahu to Yehoyakim. Let's think about Rut 1 second, what happens. Vayihi b'mei Shvot HaShoftim, Vayihi Rav Ba'aretz, Vayelech Ish Mibet Lechem Yehuda Lagur B'Shtei Moav. Who are these people? They are the princes of Beit Lechem Yehuda, the cradle of the Judean kingdom. And there was a Ra'av, there was a financial crisis in Yehuda, and what did they do? They left. Kol vayihi b'mei eino ela lashon tsar. What is the tsar? What is the pain? The pain is for people who made a decision. The pain is for people who decided that when the going got tough, they left the Jewish people. People who chose financial comfort over Jewish identity. Because what happens to Mahlon and Kilion? They marry Moabites. Yes, Ruth becomes an unbelievable person, and we'll talk about that in a second. What happens in Achashverosh? Vayihi b'mei Achashverosh, Hu Achashverosh, Hamalech, Meudu v'Kush. What do Chazal say? What's going on in Shushan? A giant party, and who participates? What do Chazal say? They say it. The Jews were punished with Haman because ne'enu misudato shel oto rasha. They enjoyed the meal of that rasha, Achashverosh. They asked to blend in. Because what is going on at this time? We lose track. The history here is critically important. According to Sefer Ezra, when does the story of the Megillah happen? When is Achashverosh, Xerxes, in English, the king? 7 years before Ezra comes back to Eretz Yisrael, he becomes the king. Basically, when? This story of Megillat Esther happens in parallel to Ezra and Nehemiah. And what are they doing? So we have to go back. The first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. The Jews go into exile for 70 years. At the end of 70 years, Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel and Yoshua Kohen HaGadol go back from Babel to Eretz Yisrael. They are, to use a reasonable term, the Ben-Gurions of their time. They're here before the founding of the state. They come back and they bring back a small amount of Jews who are under tremendous pressure from the locals. Tremendous pressure. You can read Sefer Ezra, you can cry, or Zechariah. They come back and they work hard. They decide they're coming to start the second Jewish kingdom was more important than being in Persia. By the way, Yoyachin, Yechoniah, who you can recognize from Megillat Esther, in year 37, after the Churban, is promoted in Bavel. So the Jews now have a standing in the kingdom of Bavel. We'll leave that aside. Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel and Yoshua Kohen HaGadol come back. 70 years later, who comes back? Ezra and Nehemiah. Think of that as roughly about now in the state of Israel. But they're trying to put it together. They come back. Ezra, they can't, people are intermarried. They can't find people's yuchsin. They're working hard to try to build the Chomot Yerushalayim and start a state. At this time, Mordechai and Esther are in Shushan Abira. It puts them in incredible historical context. Who are they? They're the people who decided not to come back. Kol Vayihi Bimei Enu Ela Lashon Tsar. And the Megillah tells us, who is Mordechai? Ish Yudi Ayah B'Shushan Abira Ushmo Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shimi Ben Kish Ish Shimini. Who is he? Asher Hoglam Yerushalayim, he was thrown out of Yerushalayim, yes. Im Agula Asher Hoglita, with the exile that was thrown out, Im Yechoniah Melech Yehuda. Yechoniah is not the final exile from Yerushalayim, that's Tzidkiyahu. Yechoniah happens 11 years before. It is titled in the Navi, Galut Acharash V'Amasger, the Galut, the exile of the artisans. What are the artisans in those days? The economic elite of Yerushalayim were thrown out. They were thrown out, but they left before the destruction. So the writer of the Megillah places Mordechai in a context of an economic elite. The Charash V'Amasger, that's his family. And he is a fourth generation immigrant to Persia who is now called Jesus. Mordechai. Right? That's the same thing. It's a Persian god. And Esther, Ishtar, Mary. And they are in Persia. While Ezra comes back to rebuild the second Jewish kingdom and the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. And I said that I would talk about Megillat Rut because I think the drama is fascinating. How does Megillat Rut end? Here is a woman who marries Machlonen Kilion in Moab. Moab. And she comes back and says something very simple. Amech ami Elohayech Elohai. By the way, Amech ami Elohayech Elohai in those days was a conversion. You need to declare fealty to the God of Israel. We can get into a long discussion of how this happened during the second Beit HaMikdash. This is way, way earlier. And she converts. And she comes back to Eretz Israel. Not born Jewish. She comes back to Israel and becomes completely Jewish. How do we know? It's very simple. Because what is she doing in the field of Boaz? She is collecting, right? Alakataba Shibolim. She is collecting leket, matnot naniim, the gifts that the Torah tells us to give to the poor people. Those are given only to Jews in the Torah. So she's fully Jewish. We know that. And the Megillah tells us at the end of Megillat Rut, twice it counts her lineage. Not once, twice. It tells us that she is the mother of Oved, who is the father of Yishai, who is the father of David. Because she declared, Amech ami v'loayech elokai basher techielech basher talini alin. Wherever you go, I'll go. I don't care what the hardship is. I'll collect alakataba shibolim. She is zochet in the shushelet to the lineage of David HaMelech. And the Miyad doesn't tell us that once. It tells us it a second time at the end. If you look here, first in Pasuk Yud Zayim, Vatikrenu Ashkenot Shem Nemor Yulad Ben Lenomi, Vatikrenu Shem Ovedu Avi Yishai Avid David. And then it says it again, Ve'ela Toldot Peretz, Peretz Oli Chatzon, Chatzon Oli Yitrab, Ramon Yitam Oli Nadav, La La La, Oved Oli Yitit Yishai, Yishai Oli Yitit, twice. What is the Mechaber of Megillat Rut trying to tell us? If you make a decision to emphasize your Jewish identity, your fealty to the God of Israel over the Ra'av that chased Elimelech out, you will have lineage. How does the Megillat Esther end? We have known nothing of Esther and Mordechai's children. We have this vague reference, Dover Shalom Lechol Zaro. Yes, I'm aware of Chazal who says that Koresh was Esther's son. That is very difficult to believe. I understand where they're going with it. They're trying to place the story in a different historical context. But the Megillah ends with a thud. Vayasam HaMelech HaChashverosh Mas. Attacks. Because what is Mordechai now? In place of Haman, right? Vayasam HaMelech HaChashverosh Et Mordechai Al Beit Haman. He appoints Mordechai in place of Haman. What was Haman? The secretary of the treasurer. What is Mordechai? Secretary of the Treasury. He's close to the financial purse strings of Persia right now. And the Megillah, when you contrast it with Megillat Rut, ends with a thud. Megillat Rut is in front of whoever wrote Megillat Esther. Right? He's sitting, this is the end of Tanakh. He is sitting with all 23 books of Tanakh in front of him. He knows exactly where to take from to send a message across. And it ends with a thud. First, it starts with a giant party and ends with attacks. And not just that, where is Mordechai's legacy written? Chomaseh, Tokpo, Gvorato, Farashat, Gidulat, Mordechai, Asher Gidlo, HaMelech, Achashverosh, Elohim Ketuvim, Al Sefer, Devrei Hayamim, Malchei Madai Uparas. Whose history books is he in? The Persian. And where is Rut? Jewish. I suggest that the entire story going on here is not a story of anti-Semitism. That was 4 days. It's easy to talk about. The Megillah tells us an incredible lesson of how anti-Semitism grows on fertile ground. An incredible story. It tells us the whole story. Before Brownstein and King, there was the author of Megillat Esther, but we don't know who he is. But I think he's sitting somewhere in Yerushalayim and saying, what are you doing there? Because the story of the Megillah is a story of assimilation. That's what he's upset about. And he says, if you don't come back to Israel and join Ezra and Nehemiah, if you don't come here, you will disappear into the Persian kingdom. And this is why this Megillah is so important for today. Because the big story of Yadut HaGolah today is assimilation, not anti-Semitism. When I finished writing my book, I was called in by David Bloomberg, who I know for many years, who is the chairman of the National Library here. And he said to me, I read your book, it was very interesting, you missed a very important piece of data. I said, okay, what's that? He said, between 1880 and 1910, I did not know this, maybe some of you do, between 1880 and 1910, over 3 million Jews immigrated from Poland and Russia to North and South America. If you simply multiply the population by what it's been multiplied by, from 1890-1910 to 2019, just that cohort of Jewish people should be 15 million today in North and South America. And that does not include immigration after World War I. It does not include immigration after World War II. And there's been just about zero anti-Semitism during that time period in North and South America. Where are all the Jews? Where are they? And during this time period, right here in the Middle East, there is the exact opposite phenomenon going on. And this is what is taking place. The Megillah is today. You have an emerging Jewish second kingdom then, today an emerging third Jewish kingdom, against a fast disappearing diaspora community. is disappearing. It's not disappearing because of anti-Semitism. Ilhan Omar is the last 3 months. It is disappearing because of assimilation. It is disappearing because it is actually difficult to maintain a Jewish identity when your numbers grow and you're going to college campuses. And it is, says the Bala Megillah, whoever wrote it, it is, yes, a sacrifice sometimes to move to the new Jewish kingdom, but it is imperative. If we care, and we should, about the future of our people, and this you can read in the books more, people like Elimelech, like Mordechai, are people, and they make economic decisions. Homo economicus is not an accident. People are economic animals. They want to feed their family and feed them well. That is understandable. It becomes therefore imperative that we help people create good livings in Israel. Because if we care about their Jewish identity, it will only happen here for the vast majority of them. We are, and we will lose our brothers and sisters, not to Ilhan Omar, not to people with stakes and spears and masks, but just simply fade into the background of foreign societies. And that is what the Megillah comes to warn us about. It's that. And that is our responsibility, everybody sitting here in this room, is to ask, what are we doing? What are we doing? It's a real challenge. The Megillah is challenging the people sitting in Israel. It's written in Hebrew. They did not speak Hebrew in Persia. He's asking, what are we doing to help save our brothers and sisters' Jewish identity? That is our job sitting here in Eretz Yisrael today. Purim Sameach.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.